Colonel Collins, Rail 6. Now, I wanted to ask you some questions about this rather appalling affair.
Mm.
Firstly, I believe that you feel very strongly that this is an illustration of the fog of war.
That's right, yes. Well, you see, there's so many factors. I mean, I was new. I'd only just arrived on the scene, perhaps the night before, or, you know, it wasn't more than, certainly not more than 36 hours. I was new in that company, you see, as I explained, and I really hadn't got my bearings, and the communications were poor. We were part of an American army, and certainly there were Germans in very close proximity to us. And as far as I'm aware, there were or could have been Americans as well. And their steel helmets are very similar in shape, particularly in poor light, or, you know, when partly concealed and camouflaged and that sort of thing.
You mean
so you could easily
what would have been described to you by your runner as Germans,
yes.
You're not saying they were, but they could have been.
Well,
American.
I'm just saying they could have been. Or he could have just, he could have seen an apparition. I mean, I don't know, but he was pretty frightened by something. And
But
that's the sort of thing. And the other thing is, the other thing is that, you know, there were other people better positioned to see what was going on in the battalion. I mean, Major Frank Duffy, no longer with us, sadly, but he was commanding a company further up the hill. I think I mentioned it. Was it C Company? And, we learnt afterwards that he could see perfectly well that it was my platoon manoeuvring down there. And he tried to persuade the company commander, who felt himself threatened, you see, that it was my platoon.
On the radio he tried?
Yes, that's right.
Your radio not being
operable? Well, mine wasn't on the same net anyway, you see. Mine was just a local net.
So you were manoeuvring back towards these Germans by the back towards the right-hand wall of the hospital.
When that's
you were
right.
You didn't actually see any Germans.
No,
while you were
just
doing
that. just to butt in there. You say towards these Germans. I mean, I just had to assume or infer that they were Germans. We were being fired on, but they might have been neither Germans nor Americans. They might have been our own British troops.
So the original
next battalion. You know, that's the sort of thing that happened.
The original fire that you were getting that had caused you to send the orderly back could in turn have been
our
British
own troops.
Fire.
Yes, it could have been.
So
yes.
The whole thing.
So I had to go and sort out what it was, you see.
So that's the whole thing thought. Could have been what they now call friendly fire.
That's right. Yes. And the whole thing was what we also call an MFU. If you don't know what that is, but it's a military F up. See.
Now, when you actually came under the British fire, I mean, while we were talking, you said it's horrible. It was a tribute to the registering of the
that's
mortars.
Right. Yes, I mean,
what was it like to be under that sort of mortar?
Well, I mean, it was the first time for me. It wasn't the last time, but it was the first time. And I mean, one is just cringing there, and there's nothing you can do. It's no good running, because if you run, you're bound to be caught in the blast of the next or the shrapnel. The only thing you can do is to hug the ground as closely as possible, and just hope and pray that the next one isn't going to land on top of you.
So there's no cover?
No. Well, there was the hospital wall. I remember that. And some of us were one side of the wall and some were the other, you know. Because it was at the corner of the wall.
And how tall would the wall be?
Oh, I can't remember exactly, but perhaps 8 or 10 feet, something like that, you know.
So it depended on which side you were?
Well, no, I mean, not all the bombs fell on one side and none on the other, you know. They were scattered around, but So it was horrific, that was. Still.
Now, when you were sorting out the situation afterwards, you'd managed to stop the bayonet charge of the rest of your own company.
Yes.
They then presumably tended to the wounded and, as you mentioned, started to collect the dead.
Yes.
What state were you in?
Well, I felt fairly, obviously very shaken, but I mean, I felt that a few deep breaths that I would be all right again. But I was made to go back to the regimental aid post for a check, as they said. And then I had to go and tell the CEO what had happened. And he, even then, was very sympathetic and very understanding, you know, Johnny Preston. And then he said, well, you know, well, okay, don't worry about it now, you know, we'll... And then, to my astonishment, if you'd like me to go on with my little story, the MO decided, you know, I was made to lie down with the casualties who were going to be evacuated further back. And so I said, well, wait a minute. There's some mistake here. I've only got this little bit of nick through my, you know, knuckle.
Now, so it was literally a cut or a...
You asked about the wall. There was a porthole in the wall, and it was that was about sort of 2 feet above the ground. And I, for some reason, had my hand in that porthole so that my knuckles were exposed, you see. And a little bit of shrapnel just went through my middle knuckle. Now, they may have thought it was going to sever or partly sever that tendon or whatever, but I questioned the medical staff. I said, no, there's nothing wrong with me, you know, it can't be wrong. No, I had to be evacuated. And, of course, the medical policy then was that you didn't treat people. I mean, it was impossible to treat people who might have required suturing or antibiotics or whatever, if there were any antibiotics. And you know, you didn't treat them there in the four defended localities. You got them back. And, of course, because we were just still in a little bridgehead, there weren't any. So, believe it or not, I was put on a hospital ship and sent back to North Africa. Which was, I mean, I just could not believe that that was going to be my... that was what they intended. But anyway, it was. They said, no, you have to... You have to go back and be properly treated.
You weren't given a choice?
No, I wasn't given a choice. No, no, of course one isn't given a choice.
Do you think you were showing any signs of shell shock?
No, I don't think I was at that time. So, no, not at all.
So it was just purely a medical bit of, not jobs worth real, not, you know, it was the rule and it was being followed.
That's right. It was the sort of thing which could have led to complications. And I mean, they wanted me fit and back again, is what it came to, I think. And, I mean, the hospital ship was lying off there. There was no problem about it, just getting me on it. And then I was taken back to Bizerta and put in an American hospital, where, first of all, they couldn't believe that I was an officer.
Why not?
Well, because I was so young and, and sort of straight out of the line. And
Now, while you were in hospital, did they actually treat your finger, or was it just left to heal?
No, I think it was just left to heal. I mean, I didn't have any surgery or anything. It was just dressings, and, you know, it very quickly healed. Of course, it was all quite an education to me. I mean, the American food was an education, of course, and all that.
In what way?
Well, I mean, you know, jam with bacon for breakfast and that sort of thing, which is totally alien to me. But it was really quite interesting. But I soon got fed up with that, and... I could tell you what I did next, which is going to surprise you. I mean, so I was so disappointed in what had happened. I was so keen to get back to the battalion that I discharged myself, another fellow and myself. I can't remember who he was. And we sneaked out of the hospital at night and made contact with a local United States Air Unit, and cadged a lift back to Italy via Sicily. And that was the first time I'd been in an aeroplane, by the way. Well, that was the other thing. And so I discharged myself from this hospital. I mean, I must have been absolutely mad to have wanted to get back so soon. And but we flew to Sicily, and then I got another lift from there to the Naples area. Now, by that time, not many days after, the bridgehead had been... you know, they'd broken out of the bridgehead. And, I mean, I can't say precisely where the four defended localities were then, but the first thing that I recognised, was the battalion post truck and the post corporal, one Corporal Neil, who was a very good quick bowler, by the way, but still. And he was going back to the sort of base depot to collect the post. And so I cadged a lift with him on his truck, and so got back to the battalion. And then not long after, I don't know exactly, I was sent for by the CO, of course, by Johnny Preston. And another sort of psychological shock for me, in a way. When he saw me, he was quite pleased to see me. And he said, and it absolutely took the wind out of my sails almost, because I felt that the only correct thing for me to do was to try and get back. And he said, well, good, I'm glad to see you. He said, I did ask for you back. I have asked for you back. And it hadn't dawned on me before then that, of course, he might have thought, you know, under no circumstances did he want this officer back. So anyway, it was nice of him to put me at my ease like that. And so then I went and rejoined my company. I mean, I can't remember precisely where, but I know it wasn't long before we were preparing for the crossing of the Volturno.
Now, you were given a specific job here, which is, it's in the book, it says, until the 12th of October to patrol a sector with a view to finding a suitable crossing. And you're actually named here, patrols commanded by Mitchell, Kirk, and yourself, and Miller.
Yes.
Did excellent work in this direction. One patrol crossed the river and
That's
selected
right.
what was to be the crossing place. What do you remember of those patrols?
I remember everything about them.
Could you, in as much detail as you can remember?
Well, goodness me, you're going to run out of tape if I tell you all of that. But from the beginning, we were in the sort of assembly or the rest area south of the river. I think the place was called Villa Letourneau, wasn't it? And we were in billets there, and our principal occupation when we were in the billets were twofold. One was writing what we call shell reports of the enemy shelling. Now, I don't know if you've had those reported to you, but when enemy guns are fired, what one does is to take a quick bearing with a compass, the bearing from which the flash comes, the time of day, and then you count the interval between the flash and the shell arriving, and then report it on a little form, and it's sort of handed in. And, you know, and one spent a long time doing that. And of course, the gunners were able to deduce from that where the enemy gun batteries were. We did that. The other thing we did, we were provided with some very good aerial photographs of the approaches to the river, the crossing points. And I spent hours poring over these things and committing them absolutely to memory. And I knew in my mind very clearly the sort of area that was going to be our approach to the river. And
how detailed were they? I mean, could you see hedges and trees?
Oh, yes, the aerial photographs, yes, and the farms and the tracks. And I mean, a particular patrol. I remember doing one major patrol there, to be truthful about it.
Now, how would you prepare for that patrol? I mean, How were the number of men selected? How were the individuals picked? How was it organized?
I can't remember exactly. I mean, there was a general rule of thumb, and you either went on a reconnaissance patrol or a fighting patrol.
What was the difference?
Well, a reconnaissance patrol was very lightly equipped and armed, and you might wear, you know, rubber shoes and no helmets, no equipment, just a personal weapon each, and, perhaps a compass, and very little else. The idea being to see and not be seen, and to take evasive action if encountering any enemy.
Now, would you?
That was a reconnaissance.
Black your faces or muddy your face.
Yes.
You would actually do that.
Did that as well.
Now, what about the fighting?
Mark, I tell you what, the mosquitoes were so prevalent there. It was like being in a swarm. You know. A swarm of gnats is like here, like being in a swarm the whole time. And so, and you had a mosquito net over your face, so you didn't really need to blacken really so much, now I come to think of it.
Now,
the fighting patrol, now that was quite different. The fighting patrol was a stronger, and it may be sort of up to platoon strength, but perhaps usually rather fewer than that. And they took, light machine guns and personal weapons and spare ammunition and war steel helmets and were prepared to fight for the information. So I remember in particular doing a reconnaissance patrol up to the river. My responsibility was to examine carefully and study the route up to the river, up to where were the chosen crossing place.
Now, so the other patrols had established the chosen crossing place, had they?
Or well, I don't know how that was established. No, I think at the same time, I remember going out. The one particular incident I remember so clearly was Ray Mitchell, who was named there in that history as well, and was a good friend of mine, subsequently became a company commander and so on. No longer with us, unfortunately. But Ray Mitchell and I took out patrols on the same night to the river.
Now, which type of the patrols were they? Were they reconnaissance?
Well, mine was certainly a reconnaissance patrol, and I think his was as well. And the only thing was that he... I was to concentrate on the approaches to the river on this side. He was not to bother about that, but to get to the river, get himself across in a boat, and examine the landing, you know, and areas on the other side. And we set off on the same night. I know it was on the same night for the reason I shall explain to you in a moment.
And about how many in each patrol?
Well, I think there was certainly only in mine, there were only perhaps three or four of us. And I think there were rather more in his. In fact, I was talking to somebody at the last reunion who was there. Of course, this was all not exactly fenland, but it was the sort of water basin of the river Volturno, and I suppose in the winter it may have flooded, but certainly there were a lot of dikes around. And the roads very often were raised with ditches either side, you see. And the main route up there was such a road. Now, we progressed up the road, and I did my reconnaissance on this side of the river, and I knew, ascertained what I wanted to ascertain.
Now, how did you go about it? I mean, there were four of you, four or five of you. I mean, would you just, what formation would you adopt you went across?
Mainly in single file with me leading. I mean, that's the sort of thing. But what you do is you tell off, you know, the next chap behind keeps a sharp lookout to the right. Chap behind that keeps a sharp lookout to the left. And the chap behind that keeps a sharp lookout behind, you know. And so one makes progress.
Would you leave a man behind?
What do you mean?
One man sort of following quite a bit behind?
No, no, we didn't do that. He could have been, you know, jumped on, I think, if there was such a... And
so you made your... would you go across country or down this road? Or down the road?
Well, I had to reconnoitre the route down the road, so I must have went mainly down the road, or in the ditch to the side of the road. Now, when I completed my patrol, or at least got to the objective, and turned to come back, I remembered one very important lesson in training patrols, and I regret to say Ray Mitchell didn't remember it. And that was that you don't come back the same way as you went out. And so I came back, struck another route across country. And it turned out to be a very propitious one because we went right through a melon field. And the place was stacked with those beautiful Gallia melons, and they were all ripe. And we were sitting in the middle of that field, eating these melons. And seeing our line ahead, by the way, Mount Vesuvius was always a pillar of fire by night, a pillar of smoke by day. When we were patrolling there, the guidelines, you know, was always provided by Mount Vesuvius on the way back. And we were lying there enjoying these melons, and all hell broke loose on the road that we'd gone up by. And poor old Ray Mitchell's patrol had come back down that same road, and the Germans were lying in wait. They put an ambush there to get him on the way back. And then they had to fight. He got hit. One or two others, I can't remember precisely them of the casualties, but, I just felt very gratified myself that I'd remembered that lesson. You don't go by the same route.
Now, so he'd gone Had he gone?
But he had gone across the river. He'd got across the river, by the way.
But you'd got to the riverbank as well, and looked at this side of it.
Indeed, yes, and to see where it might be possible to launch boats and where it might be possible to prepare them and that sort of thing, you know.
You only went on one of these patrols?
Well, I can only that one sticks in my memory, I think, partly because of the ambush, I suppose. But we were there some little time. There may have been other patrols at that time.
And you got back from the Mellon Field with no further incident?
With no further incident, no.
Now, so the next thing would be really the crossing,
yes.
I presume.
Yes.
Apparently the foresters went in with a noisy crossing, and you were in a quiet crossing.
That's right.
What sort of a briefing did you get before the crossing? Would there be an O group?
Well, there would have been, I suppose. I can't remember exactly. What I do remember was that I was detailed to lead the battalion up to the river. That was my job. And because I'd reconnoitred it, and so this obviously was a part of the great plan, I expect, when I was sent up there before. I really can't remember, but we must have got... whether we were taken by motor transport some part of the way, I don't know. But I know that the outline plan was that the unfortunate foresters and the Leicesters, the other two battalions in the brigade, well, the foresters at any rate, would purport to be making the main assault up the main axis and the main crossing at the place whose place name I forget for a moment, but whereas we were going to be really the, in other words, they were the decoy for us who were going to make the actual crossing a little bit further down the river. That was the brigade plan. And so we set off, and of course the thing that, what's the place called? I'm just looking at the map a moment. Cancello. That's right, Cancello, that's right. I suppose that's right, although it says 138 Brigade there, doesn't it, on that map? But we were to get now, the one or two things I remember about it was direction finding. You know of the Bofors gun, Bofors light anti-aircraft gun. We had some of those in the division, and they fired tracer rounds. And the scheme was that every 5 minutes or something, they would fire a burst of five rounds along the axis of attack, so that everybody moving forward could keep their bearings and know that that was the direction they were going. I remember that. And I was leading this entire battalion party. We were due to cross the river at a particular time. Each hour was the hour set. Now, I don't know whether I performed particularly well there, because I was very cautious in leading the battalion up through here. And because, of course, I had it very much in mind that patrol had been ambushed only a night or two before. And, I didn't want the whole battalion to walk straight into an ambush. And it was my responsibility to make sure that we got safely through. And there were undoubtedly Germans on our side of the river. And so I proceeded rather cautiously to the point that we lost a bit of time. And the adjutant, who by then was Captain Pritchard, he was a very nice man, by the way, but it just happened then that he came up to know why on earth I was being so slow, and why, and I said, well, because there are Jerrys around the place on this side of the road, and I don't want to, on this side of the river, and I don't want to walk the battalion into them. But anyway, we had to get a bit of a move on, and so in due course we got to the river. And then, my platoon leading, we had to make the first crossing.
Now, how did you go about that?
Hoisted our packs up as high as we could on our shoulders, put our rifles, stretched arms above our heads, and the first few of us waded into the river, which I suppose Ray Mitchell must have established the depth of it, but it was certainly up to my armpits, if not up to my shoulders, being a rather shorter chap. And we had to take a rope across and secure the rope at the far end. The boats were brought up, and people following on behind came in the boats. I think one or two more may have waded, I'm not sure. but then that rope was the guideline, and people, you know, handed themselves across in the boats. That's all my recollection. I don't know if the good book says anything different from that.
That's exactly what it says.
Yes. And so, of course, so there we were, soaking wet, you know, up to the armpits, and we managed, and then the whole company got across. I know that my platoon waded, and I don't know how many more did. Now, the company commander at that time was John Morant, and the company sergeant major was still this redoubtable Tug Wilson, who had done well, I noticed, at Salerno, and had been awarded the DCM, which is a very high honour. And he was even shorter and more wiry than I am. But John Morant was the company commander, as I say.
Now, while you were crossing, had there been any signs that the Germans were aware of your presence?
Absolutely none. They weren't while we were crossing. They weren't aware. And at least no signs that they were aware. And then we managed to get, as far as I know, most of the company across the other side. And then we fanned out a little bit to some extent, and control was exercised by word of mouth. And I remember then, of course, our first objective was there was a high dike, and it must have been, would it be a couple of hundred yards or something like that to the north of the river?
It says 400, but that's within the bounds of...
Well, it probably was 400. It seemed like a mile when we were there, because when we were about halfway across in the middle, somebody fell into the river and cried out, and that alerted the Germans. And then suddenly we found that all along this dike were machine gun posts. And so we came under machine gun fire.
As you were crossing the flat ground.
As we were crossing the flat
ground. Between the river and this dike.
Yes. And, you know, I had one of my other sort of painful experiences there. As one of my young soldiers, well, I mean, he was probably no younger than I was, about the same, called Anderson. I remember his name. Unfortunately, there's so many Andersons. I can't exactly locate which one it is now. But who was hit, badly hit. And he felt he was, you know, he felt he was dying. He felt he was mortally wounded. And I know, you know, I was kneeling beside him and he was giving me a message to give to his girlfriend and that sort of thing, right in the middle of this area. And, of course, we were still trying to get on and to try and secure this, the bank, you see.
Was it just machine gun fire or was it mortar and rifle?
Fortunately, no. I don't remember there being any mortar or shell fire. It was machine gun fire. And fortunately for us also, it was plunging fire. If you know what I mean by that, they were sighted above us and shooting down. And
it was a high dike then?
It was as high as that wall. You can't see that wall on the tape, I know, but it was 30 feet, that's right.
It more difficult for them to hit you.
That's right, because plunging fire, the bullets just go into the ground wherever they happen to hit, whereas... If the machine gun is on the same level as a standing man, they can sweep the ground. And
parallel fire.
That's right. And one other little amusing incident there. Sergeant Major Wilson was absolutely—he was as cool as a cucumber, as far as one could tell. Mark you, he asserted his presence all right. And John Morant was a bit sort of laconic, or he could be, and. When we were sort of getting ready, and Wilson always said, whenever he got an order, he said, "Very good, sir, very good, sir." And, of course, eventually John Morant said, "Sergeant Major, sir, I've been hit. Very good, sir." He said, "Tell the platoon commander of whichever platoon it was, you know, to take over or something." But anyway, so we managed to get onto that dike and